Good morning, and welcome to Manzanita Voices. This is a show for writers, wannabe writers, and the people who keep us going because they love to read. We have a great guest here today who has written 7 different books, and we're going to hear about them and a whole lot more. Does the title Intentional Living grab your interest? If we're going to go through this life, we might as well do it intentionally, don't you think? We'll find out more about that, so stay tuned, get that cup of coffee, and pull up your easy chair. You're going to like it here. As I've said before, we're getting more and more listeners all the time, and part of that is because you're helping to spread the word. For that, I'm very grateful. I really need you to tell your friends and family about this show, and they don't have to be right where you live. They can be across the country because people can listen online. So keep up spreading the word, and I'd like to say hello to Karen Wolf in Arizona, Bill Taylor in Western New York, Dave Lambrecht in Wisconsin, and Paula Johnson in Virginia, and they're just some of the people out there who are listening from far away. We haven't heard from Texas yet, though. How about Montana? Ohio, you don't want to be left out. Canada, Mexico, come on, let's make this an international show. Contact me from a state or country where I haven't mentioned hearing from a listener yet, and you'll get a copy of Manzanita Writers Press Anthology, Wild Edges. I'll have the staff autograph it for you. It's a beautiful 216-page book filled with short stories, poetry, art, and photography. You'll be proud to have it. All you have to do is email me at writers@kvgcradio.com. Think Voice of the Gold Country, VGC. writers@kvgcradio.com. Give me your mailing address and the book will be on its way. And I'd love to hear a little bit about yourself, too, whether you're a writer or what your favorite books are, whatever. Tell me about yourself in the email. Now, I know lots of you are writers, and probably we have artists and photographers listening, so here's another bit of news I have for you. I have an assignment for you where you might win some money and a beautiful book. So dream up something creative about wine, cheese, or chocolate, and do your stuff. Create something wonderful and send it to us at www.manzapress.com. That's manzapress.com. Along with a $10 entry fee, and you could possibly see your work in a beautiful book that our press will publish next year. You might even win a prize, one that you can take to the bank. How's $200 for the first prize in any category, and $100 for second prize? Check out the website, www.manzapress.com. You get the details there and then get creative. The deadline is December 31st. Monica says that she has received some really fine entries from as far away as New York State, but we have lots of room for more. Okay, it's time for the morning workout, but guess what? I didn't bring it. So I'll just tell you about it. I guess I left it home on my desk. I'm so sorry about that. I had 2 very nice short bits of poetry to read for you, and they're sitting right at home. I know right where they are. Anyway, your chance to get something that you've written on the air for the morning workout is to write anything, prose or poetry. It should be about 2 minutes long. Embed it in an email to me so I don't have to open attachments. And again, the email address is writers@kvgcradio.com. And if you're shy and you don't want to, you don't want me to announce your name, I won't. Just ask for that and you'll be silent. You'll be anonymous. But I would love to, give you some publicity. So if you want, I'll be happy to, tell who you are and where you're from. But anyway, get that out to me. For the morning workout. And I promise, next time I will bring these things. Okay, we've done enough housekeeping now. It's time to meet our guest, who is Linda Abbott Trapp. And I was trying to think of how I was going to introduce Linda, but there is a a town nearby here called Lodi, and in the Lodi Living section of their newspaper, there was an article by Lauren Nelson. It came out on September the 9th of this year, and she had a pretty good introduction for Linda, so I'm going to use that. Life has taken Linda Abbott Trapp across the globe and through many unique experiences. She's taught art in Ethiopia. She has studied ecotourism in Russia. She attended 17 schools by the time she earned her PhD. She raised 4 kids with her husband. She's been a dean at 3 colleges, and she created her own company. She's written 7 books, and now that she is semi-retired, she's teaching 3 different writing courses: Writing to Heal, Fiction Writing, and Memoir at Hutchins Street Square, which you can learn about by going to their website, which we'll talk about in just a minute. But first, I want to welcome Linda.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here.
It's a delight to be here. Thanks.
Well, I'm so glad to have you with us. And there's so much to talk about with all these things. Let's start talking first about those classes you're teaching. They sound pretty interesting to me. How does one go about writing to heal, and who needs to do it?
Writing to Heal is a class for brave people. It's a class for people who are willing to confront their demons. Almost everybody has been through a trauma by the time they're an adult. Trauma is inevitable. Yes. Healing isn't. And so some people remain scarred for a long, long time, whether the trauma is something like Vietnam War service or incest or any of a number of horrible things, or maybe even one of the more common traumas like death of a loved one. It's hard to heal from those without some guidance. Well, as it turns out, writing is one of the ways you can apply self-healing, because the process of writing gives you control over the words you use, control over the order in which you present facts, control over... You see, the word control is terribly important.
Control,
here.
Yes.
Because when you've been traumatized, you feel out of control.
That's true.
And the key ingredient in writing to heal is regaining control.
Uh-huh.
And so all by itself, that's a huge step forward. You do the naming, and we all know naming is powerful. When you get to pick a name for something, you're exercising a stewardship, you're exercising your ability to place it in its proper place in the universe, you're exercising a limitation on it, it's this but not this.
Mm-hmm.
And so as you name your experience, as you tell about it in your own words, in your own time, you redefine it. And that gives you a sense that you own it. And over again, students in my classes have said to me, you know, I thought I couldn't read this out loud, but it doesn't make me cry the way it used to.
Huh.
It doesn't have that power over me anymore. And that's where we're headed with that class, to take away the power of the trauma.
Now, how long does that class last?
It's usually presented in 4 one-hour segments or 2 two-hour segments. It's a short class. When I was active as a therapist, I was going to say inactive therapy, but that could be taken either way.
Yeah.
When I was active as a therapist, I specialized in brief therapy. I like to see people take action rather quickly, and I support them in doing that.
Oh, you specialized in brief therapy.
Brief therapy.
I thought you said grief therapy.
No, brief therapy.
Oh, okay.
Usually 3 times. And then go try this and this and this, and come back if you still need to talk in a few months, and we'll learn some more things, and then go try those.
I like that kind of therapy. It's a lot different from some of the therapists who keep you coming back for years.
And in some cases, that may be totally appropriate. But I'm all about empowering the individual to take charge of their own story. And so this is a way to do it. There are so many individuals with so many stories. If we had engendered dependence instead, we'd never get out to see other people.
True, that's right.
So I like to help people become in charge of their own lives and their own history and tell the story the way they want to tell it, to whom they want to tell it, when they want to tell it. So
but
you can
it
is
always
is.
Good for a person to be able to tell their story.
Absolutely.
About.
It's extremely healing. There's been research on that for at least 35 years.
Mm. What about people who need to tell it over and over and over again?
They haven't finished processing it. And they may need some help in getting at what's underneath that's still bothering them. And that's easy enough to do. It takes a little bit of quiet time talking. It takes a little time of going through certain kinds of writing exercises. You're telling the story to someone in your writing, someone who is a trusted friend, someone who will not betray your confidence. And so you set the scene in a way the person feels extremely comfortable. And then they answer a set of questions in the writing, and that liberates them from the underlying nagging feeling that something's not quite finished.
I see. Very, very good. That sounds like an interesting class. Then you teach a fiction writing course and memoir. So tell us a little bit about those.
The fiction class is a real kick because I often have young people in it who are very interested in writing about alternative worlds, alternative universes, alternative experiences, and any fiction takes the reader into another world, even if it's just down the street. Someone else's view, someone else's experience, it's another world. But they're taking it a little bit more literally, and they're going into science fiction kinds of things, and that's fun. And I've had one student who's doing a Western, a period Western, in early Mexico, and he's done the research, so the communications are right, the transportation is right, the language usage is right. It's wonderful work. That's fun. And then I have one who's very au courant, writing in contemporary Hollywood. And that is just such fun. She's a party planner, and she's dishing out gossip.
Oh, boy. And then in Hollywood, there would be lots of gossip.
That's fun. So there are many different kinds of fiction, many genres, as you know. And the people who write fiction are delightful. They have such active imaginations, and they transform everything they hear and see into grist for the mill. And it's just fun to watch the process.
Now, is that class running right now?
That class is running now. It's only a four-week class, so it'll run again in a
little while,
and again after that.
And how many people do you generally have in a class?
Oh, it's ranged from 2 to 12.
Okay.
So it just depends on what's convenient for people.
Well, everybody, get your pencils out, because we're going to tell you where you can find Linda's class. It's at www.HutchinsStreetSquare.com. That's HUTCHINS Street Square. So there are several S's in there. We'll announce it again after the break. We're going to have to break for a minute. We'll be right back. Stay tuned for more from Linda Abbott Trapp. We're back with Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field, and today we're talking with Linda Abbott Trapp about, when we broke, we were talking about the classes that she teaches in the Stockton, California area, and we were giving the website. So go ahead, Linda, tell everybody how they can find you, not just with that one website, but other ways.
For the classes in Lodi, Hutchins Street Square is the way to find, and they can call or go online. And for the classes in Stockton, the City Parks and Recreation Department is the source for those classes. And for my private writing workshop, they would need to contact me, and my email is lindaatrapp@yahoo.com. So any of those, and you'll find a contact point and someone who knows about writing classes. The other alternative is to ask for workshops in your own area. I do private writing workshops, I do writing to heal workshops, I do journaling for artists workshops, I do just teaching about various aspects of writing for short morning or afternoon sessions in a variety of communities, and I'm quite happy to do that. It's always a delight to meet other writers.
Yeah, we were just talking off air about the possibility that Linda might come to Calaveras County and do a workshop combining writing to heal with the
journaling
for artists. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell a little bit about how that works, the journaling for artists.
Well, there are many artists who have kept journals. One of the most famous is, of course, Leonardo, who left 6,000 pages of journals upon his demise. But it's a way to record your inspiration, your questions, your technical breakthroughs. I take pictures of my work and paste them in, along with some thoughts about the particular colors or design or the process that went into that piece of work. Sometimes I tell the story of why there wasn't any work during a particular period of time, what was going on, and that feeds into the Writing to Heal class, I suppose. After my husband Alan died, there was a long period when I wasn't particularly creative. And so that makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
And the page that deals with that is mostly covered with black stripes.
Wow.
So it's an instant memory for me to open to that page of the journal.
Yeah.
And I can get in touch with that very quickly just by seeing that. Well, there are obviously much more uplifting passages in the journal, too. And I can easily get in touch with those by opening the page to that piece and looking at it. The painting that I brought for you to look at today is one that I'm pleased with. So the pieces that have to do and went into that one are joyful for me to look at. And an artist's journal can be all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be colorful or it can be rather plain. I have one artist's journal that is simply typed pages, nothing else. But most of them have illustrations of one kind or another or color swatches or something. If I come across a color formula that I particularly like, I luck into a color paint that is just perfect for what I wanted, well, I'll write down how I got that. Otherwise, I'll never do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so all those kinds of
things. Sure. Yeah, you know, I had an aunt whom I was very fond of. Her name was Bente Starke King. She was actually from Denmark, and she married my uncle Ed King, and they lived in Ithaca, New York. And Bente was an artist, and she created just beautiful, beautiful artwork, mostly about flowers. And she published a book just before her death called Beautiful Botanicals. And in a way, it is a journal because she writes a lot about her personal experience with art, and then she gives beautiful illustrations. I hope that book is still doing well.
Because, it's a treasure.
Yeah,
I
it is a treasure.
I hope you have a copy that you've kept and looked after all these years.
Oh, yes, I do have a copy signed by her.
That makes me think a little bit about my book that I did in Mexico on the plants and flowers there.
Yeah, that's a beautiful book.
It is a pleasure for me to open it and remember. We lived there 5.5 years.
Where in Mexico?
We were in Puerto Vallarta, well, just north of there in Nuevo Vallarta.
Oh, I feel so sorry for you.
Yeah, and then I moved to Stockton, and people kept saying, you left Vallarta for Stockton, and I say, oh, did I get that wrong?
Well, we're not meaning to put Stockton down, but Puerto Vallarta area is lovely.
The foliage is somewhat different in
different.
The two places.
Yes, it is.
In one place you have agriculture, which is fine, and
we need food, we need to eat.
Gorgeous stuff.
Yeah.
So I basically followed my camera around for a year.
Yeah, and it's beautiful. What is the flower on the cover of your book?
That's a ginger.
A ginger.
Yeah.
And it's just a beautiful book in full color.
Well, I felt like it needed to be done because there wasn't one available at the time.
Uh-huh.
And our visitors would come and say, what's that gorgeous thing? And nobody knew. And so I thought, well, there's a hole in the market here. I see a need. I'm going to try it. I know how to do research. And there were many, many helpful people. It's wonderful when you get into a piece of research like that, how people step forward to help who actually know something about it. I'm trained as a psychologist, so, you know, I could go out and ask the plants if they were feeling well today. I really couldn't ask them their name. So I appreciated the help.
Yeah.
The Botanical Gardens there, Bob Price is the curator of that, is probably one of the more spectacular plots on the face of the earth.
Really?
I would strongly recommend that people go there. But I want to read you the dedication for this book so you have some idea what I was about.
Okay.
Dedicated to those who work to preserve the beauty of the earth and those who labor to teach children the value and wonder of their environment.
Lovely.
So it's pretty international,
that
feeling.
Uh-huh.
And even when I was in Siberia working on an ecotourism project, it was the same feeling. You know, there are all these wonderful places on Earth that we're not preserving as well as we ought.
Talk about a difference from Siberia to Puerto Vallarta.
Well, I was there in the summer.
Oh, okay. Okay. So give the name of this book.
This book is called Ornamental Plants and Flowers of Tropical Mexico. And I did the text and photos. And it's mostly accurate. I'd say there's a page that's totally wrong and maybe two things that are a bit off, because after all, I'm not a botanical genius. I'm a psychologist. So.
Would people be able to find it on...
All of my books that are in print are available on Amazon, as well as in some bookstores.
Okay, so that's Linda Abbott Trapp with two T's at the end of Abbott and two P's at the end of Trapp.
Right, and if you just type in my name on Amazon.com, the three books that are in print will come up.
That's great. Okay. So, you spent some time in Ethiopia as well. You really got around.
You can run, but you can't hide, right?
Right. Yeah, that's right. And there's a cute story about how you ended up in Ethiopia.
Oh, you think it's cute because you weren't involved. I was a potter living in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and pregnant.
How pregnant?
Quite.
Quite.
And I couldn't easily throw pots on the wheel because my belly was in the way.
Oh, dear.
And I was a bit of a grouch, I guess. My husband at the time, who was a physicist, mentioned the fact that I was a grouch. And
I'm sure he was the first to notice.
And he threw down in front of me on the dinner table one evening a brochure about a faculty exchange and said, we could go to Ethiopia. And I said, okay.
Okay.
11 days later, we were there.
Oh, my goodness.
Two young children in tow, and by that time, I was 8.5 months pregnant.
Oh, my gosh. And were you worried about having your baby away from your doctor and everything?
Well, I hear they do that there, too, you know. Hmm? They do that there, too.
Well, yes, they do, but you'd spent time with your own physician and everything for 8 months?
No, I wasn't worried at all.
No, okay, great.
Pretty naive.
Oh, too young to worry about things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember being like that.
And I felt invincible, and of course they had babies there, so that was my
politically
correct view, you know, and off we went.
Yeah.
I learned an awful
lot. And I bet it was fine.
Month.
Oh, you did.
I learned that you don't go to the hospital there.
Oh,
at the time, and this was in the 70s, at the time, I don't know how it is now, the hospital did not have sterile water or nursing care or food.
Oh, my.
Those are a few of the drawbacks, but my angels were taking care of me, and I found two couples, brothers who had married sisters, and three of the four were OBGYNs, and the fourth was a midwife.
Oh, fabulous.
English medical missionaries.
Oh.
And I had the baby in their home.
Oh, that's great.
And they took turns watching me because there was a party that night they had to go to. So Michael was born in a house with a horse looking in the window and shooting in the street, and it was all very dramatic. So,
well, I'm sure the horse looking in the window was pretty distracting from the labor pains, so that'd be nice.
Well, it was one of our quarrels, I think, in that marriage, because my husband was, as a physicist, trying to measure the forces, and I wasn't appreciative of that.
Well, I can understand you had other things on your mind. Yeah. There was a revolution that went on while you were there, too.
Yes. We arrived Christmas Day.
What year?
This was 73. Michael was born January 19th, and the revolution hit February 7th.
Oh, my goodness.
So it was rather fast sequence of events, and we hadn't really acclimated very well by, 6 weeks into it.
No.
But the company that we were representing on the academic exchange said, if you think you can do any good, stay. Here's your tickets home. If you need to leave, you can go. And we stayed for a year and a half.
All good for you.
And it was fascinating. It's one of the most beautiful, interesting places I've ever been in my life.
Yeah.
The people are absolutely gorgeous and very generous and outgoing, and I loved it.
One of the writers in our writing group, Writers Unlimited, that meets in San Andreas on the second and fourth Monday of every month and is open to those of you who would like to come and check us out, one of our writers is from Ethiopia.
I've met him. He's delightful.
Gedi Ambaw, yeah. And he's written a book called Desta and the Coin of Fortune, about this young boy who searches for this coin, this magical coin. It's a very good book, and he's a fun guy. We're going to break now. We'll be back shortly with more from Linda Abbott Trapp, and we're going to hear something from her books, her other books that she's brought with her. So stay tuned. Thank you. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field, and I would like to, before we get back with Linda Abbott Trapp, I would like to remind you again of how to reach me. Remember, I'm looking for your emails saying that you're listening, how you like the show, and you can contact me at writers@kvgcradio.com. Also, that's where you can send your 2-minute poetry or short fiction. It doesn't have to be 2 minutes long, but that should be about the longest it would take to read. It can be 2 lines if you want. I'll read it on the air, and just send that to me at writers@kvgcradio.com. Also, if you live in a state where I don't know for sure that we have listeners yet, and you contact me and give me your mailing address, I will send you a copy of our beautiful Manzanita Wild Edges. It's our anthology. It's volume number 6 that we have we published last year, and it's full, over 200 pages of beautiful artwork, photography, poetry, and prose. And it's yours if you're the first one from, say, Oklahoma or Florida or someplace. So contact me, writers@kvgcradio.com. Also go to the Manzanita Press website to learn about our staff, to learn about what we do, and all the events that we're hosting from time to time. You can do that at www.manzapress.com, manzapress.com. Okay, back to Linda Abbott Trapp. Linda, you have written a total of 7 books, and you've brought several with you. One that I've heard about, that I heard you talking about it before at a workshop, is Letters to My Granddaughters. Would you tell us a little bit about that one?
The 3 most recent books, including Letters to My Granddaughters, were written differently. Letters to My Granddaughters was written with my heart. The Ornamental Plants and Flowers we talked about earlier was written with my eyes, and Intentional Living was written with my brain. So people like the Letters book best.
Oh, they do.
That's the one they can relate to. My 2 oldest granddaughters were just becoming teens at the time that we moved to Mexico. My husband and I moved away from them to Mexico, and their parents were getting divorced.
Oh, dear.
Now, if you're becoming a teen and your life is in turmoil, it's a challenging time.
Yes, it is.
Well, I had been working as a consultant and seminar provider for years and years and years, had given over 3,000 seminars on conflict resolution and communication and all this stuff that I figured they could maybe use. And I was going away, so I couldn't offer any advice. You know how grandmas love to give advice. So I wrote them these letters. Short letters, about 2 pages each, with application questions at the end, and they're on what I figured they needed to know about.
Okay.
So everything from jealousy to confidence to teamwork to becoming who you really are, personality differences, that sort of thing.
What a gift. What a gift for them. That's wonderful. What do you mean, the exercises at the end of each letter?
Each letter has bullet points at the beginning so you can check out and see if it's anything you can use. And then at the end of the 2-page letter, there's 3 or 4 questions to apply it to your life.
I see.
So it's a very practical handbook on things that I figured they needed to know about and I wasn't going to be around to make sure they knew. But I embarrassed them both terribly by donating copies to their libraries at school.
Oh, yeah, teenagers don't want to know anyone to know that there is anyone older than them in their family.
Oh, good grief, a grandmother.
Yeah, grandmother. Yeah, so give us a sample.
Well, there's a couple of things that I thought we might want to share a little bit about today. One of them is understanding girl talk and guy talk.
Oh, good.
Because that carries over, doesn't it, into adult life where we wonder what the other is talking
about.
We
still haven't figured it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is 2 pages. The last time we saw each other, your Aunt Eileen was teasing you about boys. It's the first time I've seen you both blush and admit that there are a couple of special boys that you know. Isn't it fun? It made me think I'd better write you a letter to talk about some of the basic differences between the way boys talk and think and the way girls talk and think. I hope this will save you some confusion, misunderstanding, and heartache in the future. There are a lot of people who've made it their life work to study the differences in thinking and acting between men and women, and fortunately for the rest of us, they've written some helpful books. My favorite authors are John Gray, who wrote books like Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, and Deborah Tannen, who wrote You Just Don't Understand. Neither of these authors believes that either males or females are better. They just have different ways of expressing themselves. I'm not sure exactly when these differences show up, but I remember my girls being different in behavior from my boys very early, and I imagine you can see some of these things I'm about to explain in yourselves and your friends. Let's talk first about some of the behaviors that are different in communicating. Girls touch each other more when they're talking, maybe to brush something off a shoulder or put a curl back in place for someone else. Guys usually touch each other only to wrestle, push, congratulate, or tease each other. Have you noticed that? When girls are talking, they move closer to one another, and they like to face and look at each other. But guys would rather be further apart, standing or sitting more side to side and looking around. You see that girls move their hands more in the air when they're talking, and guys tend to keep their hands down or behind them. Of course, there are exceptions to all this, but they're generally true. Take a look around the places you go every day and see if you can pick out these differences. Both John Gray and Deborah Tannen, as well as others, say the main difference in conversation between men and women is that men, and probably boys too, are trying to figure out who's in charge, who's top dog in each situation. Women, and probably girls, are more into connecting with the other person, seeing what they have in common. In addition, they agree that males are more direct and straight to the point more of the time, and females take more of a scenic route. They say males try to lead and females try to cooperate, which isn't a very good fit. So one or both are confused when they try to interact. It would work better if two people cooperated or one led and one followed, since the two different ways of communicating don't mesh very well. Males and females use different words more frequently, and I'm not sure at what age that starts. For example, you rarely hear a man say the word precious, unless he's talking about precious metals. Nor do you hear him say the word tummy, unless he has an infant, or maybe a stomach ache. Women don't use as much of the tough blood and guts language as men do, although there's certainly some who use it quite a lot. Women, and I'm guessing girls also, answer a question with a question, and like it that way. If one says, "What do you want to do today?" the other will say, "I don't know, what do you want to do?" If you ask a guy what he wants to do, he'll just tell you. That wouldn't be a problem, except if it was a girl asking, she was hoping for a question back so she could suggest something. Girls also tend to respond to a compliment with a compliment. "That's a pretty sweater. Thanks, I like yours too." If you compliment a guy, he'll probably just say thanks and not pay you a compliment back. It's just the way they talk, so don't get your feelings hurt. Girls sometimes use tag questions at the end of a sentence. Those are little two-word questions they use in order to get a conversation going. An example would be, "That's a really big Christmas tree, isn't it?" Now she knows whether it's big or not. She just wants a comment from the other person. A guy would not use the tag question. He would just say, "It's a big tree." The most common example of this type of thing is what we call Valley Talk in California. For in the Los Angeles area, the San Fernando Valley, where supposedly it originated. That drops the tag question and just puts a question mark after everything, supposedly to get a response. For people who don't talk that way, it just sounds slightly dumb. We went to the mall, and there was this new skate shop.
Yes.
And so on and on and on. At best, it sounds insecure and very trivial, so please don't let that habit get started. When people get old enough for jobs, these differences really can cause some problems. A woman supervisor, for example, might give an order that sounds more like a question or a choice. "What do you think about helping Harry out?" A man supervisor would just say, "Go help Harry." But they both mean the same thing. You can see that it's important to always check with the other person. In this case, the smart thing would be to ask, "Should I go help him right now?" Although these differences may be changing a little as we all have more of the same experiences, they're really not changing very quickly. I'd like to make a couple of recommendations. First, entertain yourself by observing very closely some of these differences between guy talk and girl talk, remembering that neither is better, they're just different. Second, whenever you're talking with a guy, take an extra minute to be very clear and be sure you understand what their meaning is. even though it sounds like you're speaking the same language, in some ways, you're not. It's part of the spice of life and a delightful conversation topic all its own. Enjoy.
Well, gee, I wish I'd had something like that when I was, say, about 13 or 14 or even 18. That would have been very helpful.
Well, there are adults, managers, in many of my seminars. To this day, I still do some corporate training, that don't know these things.
Wow.
And can't understand why they're making the other person uncomfortable.
That's true. And it can be really difficult when you have a man working for a woman or vice versa, because feelings get hurt or things are misunderstood. I can see that definitely those examples you gave were really good.
We have gender-based expectations.
Yeah,
and
we do.
We don't know we have gender-based expectations.
Yeah, just hearing that, I realize I've got a lot of them.
Yeah.
We have about another minute or so, which may not be time enough to read something else. So why don't you talk about the different subjects that you touch on in this book, and then maybe we'll hear another example when we come back.
This book, as I said, is designed to help prevent problems and to help teenagers especially understand some things that really matter in life. And so the very first chapter is called Some Things That Really Matter, and it covers joy, love, forgiveness, creativity, wisdom, gratitude, some big things. Chapter 2 is skills that will help. Priorities, risks, goals, persuasiveness, time management, team player, saying no nicely and not, learning to lead, resolving conflict. Those are all skills. And I taught many a seminar in those skills to adults who hadn't learned them yet.
Yeah.
Then things that get in the way. This is the big ugly stuff. Anger, stress, depression, guilt, difficult people, jealousy, that sort of thing in Chapter 3, the really tough things. Impatience, change, money. 4 is becoming who you really are, a life work. It talks about birth order. It talks about why nobody thinks like you do.
That's right. Birth order is really important, and you're kind of an expert on that, aren't you?
Well, I've written some articles on it.
Yeah.
Confidence, mentors, persistence, discipline, all those things that help you become your full potential.
Oh.
And the last chapter is just my leftovers that are fun, and I wanted them in here, but they didn't fit the other topics.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, that's available on Amazon.com. It's called Letters to My Granddaughters, and it's by Linda Abbott Trapp. I think I might go get it. It sounds pretty interesting, and I'm not 18 anymore. We'll break now for another word from our sponsors, and we'll be back very soon, so stay tuned. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. We're talking here with Linda Abbott Trapp about her books. And Linda has an article coming out that she wants to tell us about.
Well, do you remember when you were saying in the introduction how many different things
you've
done? Well, I'm not the only one. Many of us have to reinvent over and over again, whether it's a layoff or a move or a retirement, and we need to decide, what am I going to do next?
Yeah, especially in this economy.
Right. So this article that's coming out November 1st is called Reinventing Myself Again, and it'll be in an online and print magazine called Going Bonkers.
Oh, okay. That sounds like a fun magazine.
It is.
Going Bonkers.
I like it.
I can relate.
Articles to them.
Okay, so goingbonkers.com.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's coming out when?
November 1st.
November 1st. Okay. I'll look for it. Okay, now your book on intentional living. That sounds very interesting as well. So, what do you have to say about that one?
I would imagine that most of your listeners have heard the phrase, in order to change your life, you have to change how you think.
Yes.
From Norman Vincent Peale to many, many others.
Mm-hmm.
You must change your thinking. Unfortunately, most of us have no clue how to change our thinking, and so we just do the same loop over and over and over. And so I knew there was a need to talk about how to change your thinking. And I was looking for a model to use to make it clear and easy to understand. And I found one while we were living in Mexico, the ceiba tree. The ceiba tree is the tree of life for the Mayan. civilization.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And you're still going to find to this day in the center of a Mayan village a ceiba tree. It's a huge tree. It's quite an impressive tree. They think that the heavens are represented in the crown of the tree and the underworld in the root system, and all manner of creatures live in it, and it's supposed to be very life-giving. And so I used it as a paradigm, and I have a diagram early in the book showing the crown of the tree as the thought patterns that we all have with all these overlapping branches and conflicting things, and we wonder where they all came from. And then there's the place where all the branches come together, and that is the emotion in my paradigm, and then the trunk is the behavior. And now that's the first thing anybody else sees, is the behavior. They can't see your thought, they can't see your emotion, they just see your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And where the trunk hits the ground, that's kind of where the consequences come in. The consequences of your behavior.
Where the rubber meets the road.
And you may not like those consequences.
Right. Yeah.
But you can't just change your behavior. You have to go all the way back up into the crown and change the thought that produced the emotion that produced the behavior. It's a chain of events. And so changing the thought is where it starts, and that's where you have the power. And it's true, to change your life, you have to change your thought. No question about it. The way you go about doing that, for example, is to challenge a thought. Suppose you have the thought when you wake up in the morning, I just can't do it. I just can't do what people expect of me. Well, challenge that. What have you done in the past? What have you been able to accomplish that someone expected of you? And just challenge that. Say, oh, yes, I can. I have, and I can again. And I may not feel much like it, but I can. And just keep challenging your thoughts. That's one of the techniques I talk about in here, with some detail and some stories, of course. But the thing I wanted to read to you is a little bit beside that point. It's at the end of the book, and it's because the ceiba tree is covered with thorns. Here, this lovely tree that I chose as a model is all thorny and bristly. And
really?
And kind of scary looking. So the last section of the book is just a page, is titled, What About Those Thorns? One of the reasons I was moved to choose the lovely ceiba tree as our prototype tree of life is that its powerful trunk and some of its branches as well are covered with fierce-looking thorns. They remind me of all the ways in which we tend to be prickly. To throw up protective barriers so others can't get too close. The kindergarten playground bully pushes the little boy down so he can feel for a moment at least powerful. The teenage girl makes a cutting remark about the new girl in class so that she can retain her position in the inner social circle in the face of the newcomer. Her banker father's business attire always includes a stiffly starched white shirt so that no one would dare to wrinkle him with a spontaneous hug. That way he doesn't have to deal with the whole messy business of human need and comfort. His VP of operations, a formidable mid-career woman, wears stiletto heels, a severe gray suit, and has her hair tightly pulled back from her face. Nothing soft and welcoming about her. Her presentation telegraphs her need to keep others at arm's length in order to feel in control and competitive with the men in her branch. Many of us use our clothing, expression, grooming, and behavior as protective layers to guard the tender self from the anticipated damage that exposure might bring. Our thorns may be designer thorns, but they still keep us lonely and unfulfilled. These thorns may discourage the attention of unwanted pests, but they might also prevent others from coming close enough to understand and care. In contrast to this shielded state, the intentional life is open and welcoming. The thorns are transformed into steps on a ladder, allowing others to reach for and partake of our fruit.
That's so true. So many people have their thorns in different ways, but they're there. Yeah. Another way is being late all the time. I think that's a really big thorn that a lot of people have.
Yes, it's a power move in some cases.
Control.
Yeah. And in other cases, it's just plain old disrespect.
Would you like to read another part from that book, or from how about another part from Letters to My Granddaughters?
If you would permit me, I'll read just a little bit of the first section, which is titled Joy.
Letters to My Granddaughters. Yes.
Letters to My Granddaughters. It's the first one I wrote, and in some ways still my favorite. And I'll read most of it, so most of two pages.
Okay.
Once in a very great while, more often if you're incredibly lucky, joy will drop into your life. It may be a simple thing, such as seeing an exceptionally beautiful flower, or it might be one of life's peak experiences like the birth of a child that triggers the emotion of joy. Whatever brings it on, take immediate action. Notice it, stop everything else. Breathe it in, listen to it, touch it, taste it, smell it, revel in it, roll around in it, suspend time and ignore everyone else. This is too important for manners, for civilized, polite behavior. Joy is elemental, real, and rare. When Kesla, the first grandchild, came into this world, I was in San Francisco attending a meeting of a group I'd worked very hard to be welcomed into. We were all so self-important, so potentially powerful, and our meeting so very informative and elegant. They must have thought I was stupid or crazy or both to abandon them in a rush, shouting over my shoulder, "She's just been born!" I ran for the parking lot, raced to Fresno, dashed into the hospital room, and held her for the first time. I remember promising, "Honey, when you're 10, we're going to Paris." Although I'd never had that thought before and don't remember why I said it. Probably it was some kind of altered mental state induced by joy. Years later, that same joy came back to visit, although it didn't look that way at first. My daughter Heather had a hard time when Carson was born. Back labor, they said. She was so exhausted, so tired from all the hours of pain. Her husband Mark was wonderful to watch with his newborn son, a giant of a man so tender, so loving, and so clearly odd. But the best moment for me was watching when he first handed the baby, a few minutes old, to Heather. Her outstretched arms and tears of joy are inscribed forever on my brain. Sometimes the grace of joy comes in time to heal a hurt or keep us from making a mistake. When we first moved into an unfinished house in Mexico, we suffered through the learning process of construction in a different culture. There were times I really hated it and regretted our decision. One day, after several days without hot water and other comforts, I was fed up. I stormed from the house in a rage, heading for the street, ready to just keep going. Right then, a flock of 50 or 60 beautiful chirping wild parakeets flew over my head and settled in the tree across the street. I looked up and said, "Okay, God, I get it. It's not about the hot water." It's not always the big stuff that brings joy, although often it is. I felt it praying, and I felt it watching puppies play. It's been there when I gazed at a mountain range, heard a lovely symphony passage, felt the closeness of holding my dad's hand when he was old and sick, watched a child learn to trust her own abilities, studied a masterful painting, or listened to a friend offer understanding and comfort. In each of these experiences, I was caught up, taken outside of myself, and set right. Joy has come in good times and in hard times. It's come to me when I was alone and afraid. The trick is to be ready, be willing to give it its due place, learn from it, and be grateful. It has its reasons, and they're not ours to predict or understand. It's a precious gift, not something we can plug in and turn on whenever we want. One time, soon after my husband Alan died, I was driving to Nevada, where I had agreed to work for a few days. I was sad and frightened about many things. Even so, I couldn't help but notice how beautifully the lowering sun had washed transparent layers of pink and purple over the mountains, and they were crowned with a light frosting of snow. In my loneliness and frustration, I spoke out loud, "Oh, Alan, I wish you could see this." Just then, I heard him say in the clearest, sweetest voice, "You should see it here." The rush of joy told me he was fine, in a better place, and I could let go and move forward. I never heard that voice again, and I never needed to. We are all, every day, standing on holy ground. Most of us never notice, but when we do take or allow a break in our constant self-involvement, our repeated mental murmurings about wanting and needing and hurting and being angry, tired and treated unjustly, then, just then, joy has a chance at us. We can be fully alive, nailed to the moment, bleeding tears of gratitude, expanding so quickly that it hurts and forces us to inhale sharply.
That is beautiful.
Thank you.
very moving, very touching. That is from Letters to My Granddaughters by Linda Abbott Trapp, available, by the way, on Amazon.com. Linda, we need to close soon, but I just want to quickly mention this show is going to be broadcast probably in mid-October or a little bit later. You have some artwork appearing in a show in Sonora. When is that show?
That show I don't know yet about because it's a juried show, so I'm submitting some artwork.
Oh, you're
submitting. I have some right now in a juried show in Stockton.
Oh, fabulous. Where is it?
It's at the Elsie Goodwin Gallery on Miracle Mile, Pacific Avenue in Stockton. And I've had a piece, my first painting was in a show in Hutchins Street Square, which was great fun. And I have some more coming up. It's a new aspect of who I am. I'm reinventing myself again, as the article says, and I'm loving every minute of it. It's a lot of fun.
Well, that's great. That's great. So if you live in this area, near Calaveras County or Tuolumne County or down in the Stockton-Lodi area and you're near a gallery, look to see. You might see something by Linda Abbott Trapp in there. And if you do, I think you'll find it's lovely because she has a painting here in the studio and it's beautiful. We have to close now. Linda, it's been really nice having you with us today. Very interesting day. Very interesting interview. And I do appreciate your coming and maybe you'll come back and see us again someday. Thank you. This is Linda Field, Manzanita Voices. Please come back and hear us again next week, 9 o'clock. Until then, have a great life.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.